Welcome to Meet the Writers. I'm Georgina Godwin. The show today was recorded at the Emirates Airline Festival of Literature in Dubai. My guest is very much alive, though her work concerns death. As a forensic anthropologist, she solves mysteries, and as a New York Times best-selling author, she writes them too, over 30 so far. Her Temperance Brennan series has been turned into the hugely successful TV serial Bones, and in her day job, she's testified at the Rwandan genocide trial, exhumed mass graves in Guatemala, and was part of the disaster mortuary operational response team at the World Trade Center disaster. Kathy, welcome to Meet the Writers.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
Before you were a writer, you were a forensic anthropologist, but actually you started as a bioarchaeologist. I'm wondering how you got there and actually what it is.
There's a lot in common between the two expertise. A bioarchaeologist is an archaeologist, someone who studies ancient cultures, but through the skeleton, through the bones.
Is that the sort of thing that a 15-year-old kind of says that she wants to do?
No, I didn't know about it when I was 15. I took an archaeology dig as an undergraduate, and once I took that dig, and accidentally, we didn't intend to dig up a burial area, but I did. That was the thing that was in my particular square that I was assigned to, was a skeleton. And I was just in awe of the whole idea that I'd dug up this person that had a life, and, you know, I'd spent a lot of time thinking about when they lived and what it was like and when they died. And then I took physical anthropology classes, and I just was in love with it. And I got my degree in that, went straight on through my master's and my doctorate, and was happily doing bioarchaeology, ancient skeletons, in my lab when police started bringing me cases.
And so you made the crossover to forensic anthropologist.
I did. Well, I love archaeology. It's fascinating. You're not going to impact anyone's life with it, whereas when you give a family an identification, or when you testify in court, you really do have to be right. You can't just get into long discussions with your colleagues in the literature. So I liked that. I liked the relevance of that. I retrained. I took my board certification exam, and I've been doing that ever since.
What exactly is it?
We're physical anthropologists with a specialization in the human skeleton, combined with a specialization in kind of police science, I guess, the proper recovery of human remains, the proper protocol for adhering to chain of custody evidence, a lot of things that bioarchaeologists don't have to worry about. So we work for medical examiners and coroners, law enforcement, the military, a lot of human rights work, disaster recovery work, in recovering and identifying human remains, and in some cases addressing questions of cause or manner of death. What happened to the person? What can we see in the bones that tells us what happened? Sometimes the question is, what happened to the body after death? Was there a dismemberment? Was it treated with chemicals, that sort of thing? Was it buried? Was it thrown in the water? And sometimes the question might be post-mortem interval. How long has it been since that person died?
So could we look at some of your big cases? I mean, I know, for instance, as we said at the top, you were involved in the Rwandan genocide.
Yeah. Anytime you have accusations of genocide, it's just like any other criminal accusation. You have to bring specific charges against specific individuals. So I was asked to testify in the case of a man who was accused of killing, I think it was 23 people, and burying them on his property in Kigali.
And so how do you go about doing that?
Well, in that case, I didn't do the actual on-the-ground excavation and analysis, but I was asked to review the entire dossier pertaining to the case and to the identification and recovery of those remains.
You were also involved in mass graves exhumation in Guatemala.
Yeah, the civil war in Guatemala, some 100,000 to 200,000 people were killed. So there's now some attempt to, and buried anonymously in many cases. So there's some attempt now, there is a permanent foundation, the Forensic Anthropology Foundation of Guatemala, to get those people back up out of the ground and get them to their families. So I went down there at the invitation of the Forensic Anthropology Foundation of Guatemala, because they're very open to having external input, to keeping state of the art with what it is that they're doing. So I did help exhume a mass grave up in the Highlands with that team.
Mm-hmm. It also goes quite far back. I mean, for instance, your work on World War II remains, Korea, South Asia. Tell me a little bit about that.
That's through the Central Identification Laboratory for the United States military. We have a commitment to our troops that if we send you overseas, we will bring you home. Doesn't matter how long it takes, we will try to find you and bring you home. And war dead are being identified from primarily Southeast Asia, but also the Korean War and World War II at the Joint POW MIA Accounting Command, or JPAC, in Hawaii. So anytime there's a positive identification of a soldier, that has to be reviewed at many levels, one of which is an external civilian expert, and that's the capacity in which I functioned.
And now the World Trade Center, of course, that's the one that everybody would have heard of. How were you involved there?
As a member of what's called DMORT, the Disaster Mortuary Operational Response Teams. These are a federal network of teams in the U.S. that exist permanently, but they're only activated within different regions if there's a mass fatality situation, such as an airline crash or something like the Twin Tower attack. So I went to New York as part of the DMORT assistance teams to help. It was mainly recovery because everything was so fragmentary, there really wasn't identification going on site, but to help identify what was human, because there were a lot of restaurants, catering services, so things like that. So there was a lot of animal bone in the debris. So figuring out what is human, and then we would tag it, and the medical examiner van would come and pick it up each day. It was really later, almost exclusively a DNA incident where people were identified through DNA.
In an incident like that, which has touched emotions so deeply around the world, how easy is it to remain just a scientist who's just doing her job and not be touched by the horror of it?
Well, that one was tough. It was physically tough. We worked 13-hour shifts. We had to wear hazmat gear, and it was also emotionally tough, I think. Everyone was fragile in America at that time. But everybody wanted to help. Everybody wanted to do something. They wanted to donate money or donate blood or donate, sweatshirts, whatever. I think I was lucky I could actually get out there and physically dig through debris and help with the recovery effort.
Mm-hmm. You also teach FBI agents. What is it that they're learning to do from you?
Yeah, I'm not doing that currently, but I did that in Quantico at the FBI Academy. It was a multidisciplinary course that brought together scientists, pathologists, dentists, cadaver dog experts, forensic anthropology, crime scene recovery, and we would teach special agents the proper protocol to follow when recovering human remains, how to get the maximum amount of information both from the bones themselves and from the context of where they'd been found as well. Because once you recover, it's like an archaeological site. Once you dig it, it's gone. You've destroyed it. So you have to get the information out before you do destroy it.
So how long is information available within bones? Presumably, as a bioarchaeologist, it could be hundreds of years.
Well, as a paleoanthropologist, it could be millions of years. It depends on what it is you're looking for. It depends on how preserved are the remains. Something like a 4-million-year-old, like Lucy, 4-million-year-old fossil hominid, you can get a lot of anatomical information, but you're not going to get any DNA. Something that's been left, in a tropical rainforest such as Southeast Asia, it could be 2 weeks. And it's completely decomposed and degraded because of the acidic environment. So it just depends on what it is I get to work with, what kind of information I can get, how well preserved it is, and what kind of information I can get from it.
Mm-hmm. Your caseload is so fascinating. So I imagine that writing books based on your experience was the next logical step.
Well, it was for me. I mean, they say write about what you know about. I knew about being a forensic anthropologist. I knew about being a female forensic anthropologist working in a combined crime lab and medical legal lab. So it just, when I decided I was going to try to write fiction, which I had not done before, it just made sense to me to draw on myself and my own experiences and my own cases, my own stories. Now, I never actually use a case verbatim. I take the central idea from a case and then I spin it off. Well, what if this happened? What if that happened? I change all the names and the dates and the places and then I just spin it off into fiction.
So your first book in 97, Deja Dead, was a huge success. Did that present a problem in terms of your career focus?
Well, it was a little daunting at the time. I mean, it was wonderful to jump right on to number one on the London Times, for example. It was a little daunting to go ahead and write the second book, though. Is this a one-book wonder, or can she do it again, I'm sure, is what everyone was asking.
But you carried on in your day job as well as writing?
I did. Through the first two, I was still teaching full-time at university and commuting between North Carolina and Quebec doing casework. Now, after the second book came out, I was given sabbatical at the university, and then that ran 6 years or whatever the legal limit was. And then I'm still on faculty, but I'm not teaching. They transferred my line from the department to the chancellor's office. So that gave me a lot more freedom. I was just doing casework and writing.
So your lead character in the Bones series of books is Temperance Brennan. How much of you is in her?
Well, professionally, Temperance Brennan and I do exactly the same thing. We work in crime labs. We commute between the Carolinas and Quebec, which are very, very different culturally, geographically, climactically, linguistically. As far as an individual, she's really her own person. I wanted her to have flaws. I wanted her to be approachable, to not be perfect. So I gave her difficulties with alcohol, and her love life is a mess. I mean, that's all Tempe's. That's not mine.
It's certainly not yours. Your husband is sitting just at the next table.
This is true.
So the books are based on yet more of your fascinating caseload. Deja Dead is the first serial murder investigation.
It was a gentleman in Montreal who had killed two women after the second woman, he was arrested, and he admitted to having killed a third woman 2 years earlier, dismembered her and buried her in five locations. So I was involved in recovering her remains. And it wasn't so much a question of identity, because we knew who it was supposed to be. We confirmed that, of course. But what could I see from the bones that might suggest who the perpetrator was? So I found some rather unique patterning in the way the dismemberment had been done. And that was hopefully telltale testimony in the court trial. I'm one of a team. I don't do it by myself. So I was one piece of evidence that was introduced in that trial.
Death du jour. Now that's a really fascinating sort of cult murder. Tell me about that.
Yeah, death du jour came from a combination, and I often do this. I'll take two different situations. One was a woman, we did the exhumation and analysis of her remains. Her name is Jean Lebert. She died in 1714, and in the late 90s, she was proposed for sainthood. So the Catholic Church hired a team of us to exhume what they thought were her remains, just to make sure they had the right set of bones. So I had that on my mind, the idea of, someone who died hundreds of years ago and has been proposed for a saint. That same year, the first deaths in the cult, the Order of the Solar Temple, took place in Quebec. And that triggered the events that took place the following day in Switzerland and France, where some 75 people in this cult killed themselves and killed each other. So I had that thought on my mind as well. So I kind of combined the two different things into a multi-leveled story, juxtaposing, this experience with the Catholic Church to something very, very different experience with this apocalyptic cult.
Now, you're based in Quebec a lot of the time, and I know that one of your books, I think it was Deadly Decisions, stems from the Quebec Hells Angels.
Yeah, we had quite a biker war going on back again. That one was back in the 90s. The Hells Angels were battling it out with a local group of talent called the Rock Machine over control of the drug trade in the province, and they were knocking each other off with regularity. That pretty much came to an end. There was a special unit, and I talk about Tempe working with this Kakaju unit, which means the Wolverine unit, was created specifically to deal with these biker gang wars and the violence as a result of the biker gangs. Interestingly, many of those people went to jail at that time, and the biker games became very back burner, very quiet. They're all getting out now, getting out of jail, so curious what their reaction. I don't know that they read my books.
Now, there's a case that you did for wildlife agents. This was all about moose remains. That was in Bare Bones. Tell me about that.
Gosh, I forgot about that. Yeah, I came into the lab, and usually we have a morning meeting. I will look over what's a written request for expertise form, and it has the bare bones, if you will, of the case on there, who the pathologist is that's requesting it, and a little bit of information. And there was a word I didn't know in there. It was orignal, and I thought, whatever, and I rushed off to the morning meeting. And I came back to look at this case, and it was just some leg and hip bones sitting on the counter. And I thought, this is the biggest human being I have ever seen in my life. This guy must have been suffering from a pituitary disorder or gigantism or something. And then I went and I looked up orignal, and it's the kind of a Quebecois word for moose. It was actually a moose case. Somewhat, you're allowed to kill one moose a year, I think. And there was a poacher who was killing multiple
Meese,
I guess. Yeah, exactly. So they wanted to try to nail this guy, and they wanted me to, they'd found meat remains in his freezer, and then the moose back out in the woods, and they wanted to be able to tie those together to physically tie him to the killing of it. So, yeah.
So it doesn't even have to be human.
Normally, if I get non-human remains, I will determine that this is not human, and that will be the end of it. There are a few unusual situations where it will be of forensic interest.
I want to turn now to Israel, and this is such an interesting book, Crossbones, going right into the heart of Christianity, really.
Yeah, the idea for Crossbones was actually given to me by an expert in first century Roman-occupied Palestine. He's a professor at the University of North Carolina at Charlotte and has done some archaeology in Jerusalem, in and around. He runs the only archaeology dig just outside the wall of the old city that goes, they don't care about religion. They just, whether it's Muslim or Christian or Jewish, they're digging archaeology for what archaeology will show. It's called Dig Mount Zion, I believe is the name of, and it's open to anyone who wants to do it. He came to me with a picture of a skeleton that had been found in a particular location and a story of some strangely disappeared skeletal remains that were found at Masada, over the edge of Masada, and were very quietly shuffled away, and nothing was ever published about. They were analyzed by a physical anthropologist, but no one published anything on these remains. And then this one complete skeleton, nothing had ever been published on. So he said, this would make the great basis for a story. And I said, yeah, it really does. So off we went to Israel, and I visited. I never write about a place I haven't visited. So we went to Masada, and we went to these caves, and we spent a lot of time crawling around down in old tombs and things. It's quite an interesting experience.
Jesus' brother makes an appearance.
Well, he does have a minor role in the story, yes.
It's a fascinating book. Break No Bones goes back to your archaeological roots, and you look there at the physical evidence of organ theft.
Yeah, there were some scandals in the back at the time I was beginning to formulate an idea for this book, one of which involved Alistair Cook, I think, who's bones. So sometimes bones will be sold illegally for bone transplant and bone grafts, and they'll get into these donor programs that are normally very, very carefully vetted, but there's a black market in organs and bones. So that intrigued me. The idea of that intrigued me. So I said, what if this, what if that, and spun it off into the story.
And, of course, the story has now become a huge hit television series. Tell me about your involvement, actually, in the Fox series of Bones.
I'm a producer for Bones, and I read every script, and we've now had 264, I think it is. We're the longest-running scripted drama in the history of Fox. But back in the early days, I would read them mainly to give input on the science, to keep the science honest and plausible. We push it to the edge, you know, we push the envelope, but everything you see on there, the terminology that we use, that's all, it's real, it's correct. I also write some episodes. I co-write them with my daughter, Carrie Reichs, who's an author as well. Yeah, mainly I consult with the writers and am a writer myself.
How similar is Tempe in the book and Tempe on the screen?
There's a difference between the book Tempe, and I think of them that way, book Tempe and TV Tempe. TV Tempe is younger. She's in Washington, D.C., whereas book Tempe commutes between North Carolina and Charlotte, unless she's in Guatemala or she's in Jerusalem or wherever. So there are differences. TV Tempe works with an FBI agent. She tends to get a lot more involved in the investigations than in reality, than I do, for example, or even than book Tempe does. She goes out and interviews witnesses, and she ends up, you know, in the big climax scenes at the shootout, that sort of thing. That would be rare for a forensic scientist. In the book, she's an older character. She's been married. She's had alcohol issues in the past. I never go into the details, but we know she's had a colorful period in her past, so she's a non-drinker. So there are differences between the two.
You also write young adult novels. Is that with your son?
I write the Viral series with my son. It's middle grade to young adult. The main character and my son, Brendan Reichs, who dumped me, he now has his own series being launched on March 21st. It's coming up in about 2 weeks, called Nemesis. The Viral series, the main character is Temperance Brennan's 14-year-old great-niece, Tori Brennan. And she and her friends, three boys, they're not the cool kids at school, but they love science and they love to solve puzzles and mysteries using science, cold cases. And they also, we learn about it in the first book, they acquire some special perceptive abilities, shall we say. They're not vampires. They're not, but they do have these special sensory abilities that give them a unique take on life.
Absolutely fascinating. I wonder how that working relationship is. Oh, you talk about your son dumping you. You write with your daughter too. You know, Mom, must we do our homework?
Well, it is very interesting because they're both attorneys who are now writers and don't practice law. My son is a litigator. So he and I would separate out who would write what parts, and then I would do all the editing, destroy his art, as he would put it. And then we would have editorial meetings and discuss our creative differences. And those meetings could get a little heated at times, and then we ended up doing it my way. So, but now he's actually gone on and is finishing a master's in fine arts in creative writing, focusing specifically on young adult.
Your books are really very scary at times. I wonder if you're ever frightened by the nature of your work.
I don't go out and put myself at risk like Tempe does on TV or in the books. The biggest threat to me, I guess the scariest thing to me, would be more the microorganisms. If something is going to kill you, it's probably going to be some microorganism. And we're very, very careful now. In the early days, not nearly as much, but now we wear gloves and you know, practically biohazard suits and goggles and masks when we're in the autopsy room. We're much, much more careful.
I wonder about the process of it, if there's a sort of regular structure for the kind of book that you write where fear does build. So, if, for instance, yeah, tension has to build by page 3, body discovered, chapter 4, terrified by page 136 or whatever.
I don't do it quite as that structured, because when I began writing, I had no training in writing. I didn't know what I was doing. I was just making it up. I tried to write a book that I would like to read. But yeah, I think the definition of a thriller is that there is that imminent danger to either the main character or someone close to the main character. So you do have to build to those kinds of pivotal points, and then of course your ultimate climax scene. It's a bit formulaic in that somebody gets killed and then somebody gets caught for doing it, in my books, with one exception. There is one exception where the perpetrator isn't captured at the end. It's Monday morning. But then there was a follow-up book to that 10 years later, so called Bones Never Lie. So we did resolve that situation. But yeah, I think there is a bit of an ebb and a flow. You want to have peaks and valleys and ebbs and flows, but ultimately building to greater and greater tension.
Mm-hmm. You're obviously an enormously respected scientist, and I wonder if you have to stop yourself from including some of the technical detail just simply because a lay audience wouldn't understand.
You absolutely have to keep the science brief. And I think it's a three-pronged thing. You have to keep the science brief, you have to keep it entertaining, and you have to keep it jargon-free. You can't rely on all that special terminology we use as experts to each other. So that's the trifecta I think many scientists and academics trying to make the transition to writing commercial fiction fail to make. The reader wants to learn something. So you also, at least for me, you have to keep the science accurate. You can't make it up. It has to be correct. But you do have to keep it brief, and you have to keep it entertaining. They don't want to read a textbook, but they do want to learn something.
Well, finally, let's talk about your new book, Two Nights.
Yeah, Two Nights. This is a complete departure. It's a new character. Sunday Night is her name. It's a new setting. She's headquartered in Charleston, near Charleston, South Carolina. And it's a whole new premise. It's more of a psychological thriller. She's had a very, very difficult, very unique and difficult childhood, she's kind of a spin-off character from my second book, From Death to Jour. I won't say any more than that, although we already talked about the fact that that book discusses cults, doomsday cults. So she's a bit of a recluse when we meet her, and she's had a very difficult childhood followed by some real failures. She's been in the military, she's been a cop very briefly. And she gets drawn into an investigation, a search for a missing teenager, not because it's her job. She's not a PI, and she's not a cop, and she's not a forensic scientist, but because she's personally compelled by the individual story of this child. She's personally compelled she's drawn out of seclusion to try to help find this missing kid.
Are you a writer, or are you a scientist?
Yes. I am both. I was a scientist first, but you have to write. Yes, but then you make the transition to fiction writing, which is really quite a different animal from scientific writing. But I do both. I left brain, right brain. I don't know how to explain it, but I like to read. And I think I actually have a colleague who's talking about writing a book, a novel. And I said, well, what do you like to read? And he said, well, I don't read. I said, how can you hope to write a novel if you don't read? So that's where my training came from for the writing side of me.
Well, listeners, if you read anything, make sure it's Kathy Reich's. Fantastic author, so interesting. And just thank you so much for coming on to speak to me.
Oh, thank you for having me on your show.
So Two Nights is published by Penguin Random House, and it comes out in July. You've been listening to Meet the Writers, thanks to production team of Claire Urban and Tom Furse in London and the Emirates Airline Festival of Literature in Dubai for facilitating locally. You can download this show and previous episodes from our website or app, from SoundCloud, Mixcloud or iTunes. I'm Georgina Godwin. Thank you for listening.